Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
You are listening to Missed Apex Podcast. We live F1. Welcome to Missed Apex Podcast. It's another mailbag episode. I'm your host, Richard Reddy, but my friends call me Spanners. So, let's be friends. Hello from a little blue shed in the depths of Bedfordshire, England. Yes, it is a real shed. We're moving soon, so the shed will be no more. So I must make sure to do a little tour of the shed, because the podcasting shed is about to become a nice little painting studio for the lady that's buying our house. But no time for that now. Today we have another chance to answer your questions. Thank you very much. We do build these up. The way to get your question submitted to us is feedback@missedapex.net. But none of this changes that we are an independent podcast produced in the podcasting shed with the kind permission of our better halves. We aim to bring you a race review before your Monday morning commute. We might be wrong, but we're first. Today, I'm joined from America Land by Matt Two Rumpets.
Almost done with my Carlos Sainz strategy calculations.
And there is a Carlos Sainz strategy question and some tyre questions. I do get insulted, Matt. People say, here's a tyre question, probably for Matt, when I'm the most interested tyre person on the whole panel.
Well, you know so much about them. I mean, it has become a feature of your reporting on Formula One to be an expert on the tires.
So we were podcasting when Pirelli first came into Formula One. Can you remember the year?
Was it 2012?
I think we're going to go for 2012, although our next panelist may well know. But I remember us talking about the change, and you quickly realized, I think, before any of us, that the tyre strategy was going to become key. And you were really pushing very early on to talk about the tyres. And I was like, oh, no, man, are we going to talk about tyres again? But before that, tyres were not a dominant factor in how you would discuss the race. Yes, we knew Schumacher had specially bespoke Bridgestones, and then loads of other people had Michelins. But it wasn't fundamental to the sport in the way it is now.
No, I mean, but the thing is, tires are always fundamental to the sport, but especially if you go back to when we had tire wars, because they were proprietary and because testing was involved, there was a lot less known about them from our side of the fence.
So the Bridgestone-Michelin battle was sort of comparable to the Mercedes versus Ferrari versus Renault engine battle of, say, 2014.
Yeah, exactly. It made it very hard to tease out what was an issue because the tires were being essentially they were bespoke tires for the teams that could afford to spend to have them developed for them, which is, you know, a thing that Ferrari was often accused of having an advantage with frequently when they weren't racing at Indianapolis, I believe.
Correctly accused of having an advantage with, in my opinion, allegedly. There we go. Lawyers satisfied. But we, instead of us scrambling around trying to remember dates, let's bring on someone who I suspect has an eidetic memory. It is Chris Stevens. Hello, Chris. What year was it?
It was 2011.
2011. So you were holding up two fingers to try and help me out. And I thought that was indicating a two. So i.e. 2012. But yeah, so it's 2011 that Pirelli came in. And they didn't come in really with the best of reputations. I think they got given a brief. They followed the brief. The tyres were falling apart. And I really do wonder if their sales suffered. Because why would you want to buy tyres from a company whose race tyres just fall apart and are chocolate tyres?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, they were asked to bring high-deck tyres and then people said, well, what does that say about their road tyres? Of course, it doesn't say anything at all. If they're making tyres that can withstand the pressures of a Formula One car, then you can pretty much, you know, rest easy on their road tyres being substantial enough for you.
Yeah, it's like there's never been an issue that they couldn't make those tyres last. Yeah. Of course they can if they wanted to.
Yeah, of course. Mm. I mean, I would still argue that Michelin is probably the best global manufacturer of tyres, and that's why they have like the most motorsport contracts. You would have people like Goodyear, Bridgestone, and Pirelli in the mix there as well.
Okay, well, speaking of contracts, I've got a question to ask you, Chris. Are you ready for my question?
Yeah, go ahead. I like questions.
So next weekend is the Hungarian Grand Prix. And as you know, here at Missed Apex, we do a race review show on a Sunday, ready for your Monday morning commute. Chris Stevens, would you please come and join our panel for that race review?
I'm afraid I can't, Spanners.
Why? This is outrageous. How dare you? What possible reason could you have for not joining our race review, Chris?
Well, you see, there's this other motor racing event on. It's called the London E-Prix. I don't know if any of you guys have heard of Formula E or anything like that, but I'm going to be there commentating on it.
Never heard of it.
You're going to be doing the trackside commentary for the London E-Prix. Chris, you have been a fantastic commentator for the Missed Apex iRacing series, and it is amazing to see you get this recognition. It's not on any of the global feeds, but the people in the ground, in the stadium, will hear your commentary. That is a massive gig in all motorsport. It's a massive gig, actually. I know the person that does it in Formula One as well. A huge congratulations. I think this is a stepping stone on you being recognised for your ability to call a race and bring it to life.
Thanks, man. And I don't know, I felt a bit cocky saying it like that. But honestly, since I got the news, I've been wandering around going, how has this happened? And Matt tried to get me all teary-eyed right before we started the broadcast as well by telling me how proud he and Mrs. Trumpets are, which was a horrible maneuver to go for. But yeah, no, thanks, guys. And thanks, everyone who's tweeted me and sent me a message. And yeah, it's just...
Well, Matt, of course we're proud of him. We had him on here as a 17-year-old... Dweeb, we've put the work
right in behind the ears, knowing nothing, couldn't even find the corner where he was supposed to meet me when he came to New York, and now look at him.
Couldn't even have the mic facing the right direction or plug the right thing into the right desk. But of course, we feel a little bit of ownership from you, Chris, having had you on the show since you were a teenager. But if you want to hear Chris in action, go and check out Mr. Apex Motorsport channel on YouTube and you can see how you bring a race to life. Of course, stadium announcing, Chris, it's a little bit of a different beast. You will have to spend a significant amount of time, you know, will the person parked in the disabled space with the BMW that's on fire please come and move their car?
Yeah, exactly. Please move it or it will be moved for you is the classic line.
No, of course, it's very exciting and you get to do a lot of top interviews as well within the e-village.
I think most of my stuff is going to be on the trackside commentary. I'll see when I get there what else would they want me to do, but it sounds like a really exciting package that we've put together, and I cannot thank Loudspeaker and my agent Gemma enough for helping with the opportunity.
It's not an Oscar speech. Don't sit here thanking your agent. My goodness. This is the listener feedback episode of Missed Apex Podcast. So when I look around my panel to see who can pick the first question out of my mailbag, I'm going to look around to see who's got the best gigs coming up. Matt, are you doing trackside commentary for any major motorsport events?
No, but I did do a chamber music concert at Lake George last Friday.
No one cares about music. Chris, you get the honor of picking the first listener question.
Okay, great. Well, this one comes in from Robert Fleming, who on a recent rewatch of the movie Rush, Ron Howard's classic.
Ooh, yeah, good movie.
Docudrama of the 1976 World Championship battle between James Hunt and Niki Lauda, one of the best motor racing films ever made, caught a bit of commentary in that during the Japanese Grand Prix section of that, where they talk about Jody Scheckter in the six-wheeled Tyrrell.
Yeah.
And he goes, did I hear that correctly? There was a six-wheeled F1 car. Yes, there was. It is a very bizarre idea, to the point where apparently Jackie Stewart choked on his drink when he was told about the idea. But it is, honestly, one of the most famous quirky designs ever produced in Formula One.
Well, now this, I mean, this, Matt, if we were having tech chat back in the 70s and 80s and 90s, it would be a very different tech chat to what we're having now. We have talked about, you know, the soul of the sport. Should it be a spec series? Which bit should be different? Yeah. But really, if you compare modern F1 to those times, modern F1 is a spec series.
Yeah. I mean, imagine a rule set where the number of wheels isn't something that they bother to specify.
Spanners, it's interesting you mention spec series.
Ooh,
because
okay,
the design came about because pretty much everyone except for Ferrari at this point in time was using the same engine, the same gearbox, and the same tires. So where do you find your competitive advantage? And that is where Derek Gardner came up with the idea to put four very small front wheels on the car to basically improve the front end grip. And they even convinced Goodyear to produce these special 10-inch tires solely for their car and to keep it very much under lock and key. It was kept a secret from even the drivers.
I mean, if you remember, Matt, you know, we were speaking to Matthew Carter, who, by the way, we couldn't get a show with this week, but is very keen to come and speak to us soon. When he was talking about his days as team principal at Lotus, I think it was the 2014 season, where there was a lot of interesting nose geometry. And if people want to look it up, 2014 Lotus F1 car, it had an asymmetric twin tusk nose. So one tusk was longer than the other. And that was to try sort of circumvent the rules saying, you know, the nose had to be a certain height, a certain length, it had to exist in a certain zone. Well, they went, okay, well, in that case, we can have one nose doing one thing and one nose doing another.
I'll tell you what else they had as well. In 2011 was a front-facing exhaust.
Oh.
It came out, like, pretty much where the front of the side pods were, rather than, you know, traditionally coming out the back. The idea was it was going to channel more air through more of the car.
Yeah.
Didn't quite work out.
Oh, no, but that was after Red Bull. Oh, no, after Braun, actually.
Yeah.
First, well, was that the first time that we heard about the exhaust fumes being used to help with downforce? So in 2008, they had a rear blown diffuser. They used 2009, yes. They used the rear diffuser, the exhaust fumes, to blow onto a certain part of the rear aerodynamics to create more downforce.
Yeah, so yeah. 2009 was like the double diffuser, and then 2011 was really when the exhaust gases like came into it as well, where they were able to keep the exhaust gases flowing even when the driver wasn't on the throttle.
And that would help with the aero.
Exactly. That's why it made that sort of spitting noise as well, that under braking. And it was a very, a very like great idea that I'm sad we still don't have in Formula 1.
Was that the exhaust fumes making that noise? Because, I suppose as you're braking,
you're braking.
Please let me guess to see if I can, because okay. I know you know. Let me see if I can tease it out. So you're braking and slowing down and therefore not using using the gas to keep going, yet you are trying to keep the exhaust up. So do you end up with like petrol in the exhaust that's unused? Does that create the pop?
I don't know if it's petrol in the exhaust. Maybe Matt or Summer is a better person to ask, but it was about like keeping the throttle sort of like 5% open.
Okay, but wouldn't that then generate like petrol fumes in the exhaust that would lead to a pop sound, maybe, Matt?
I think it would. Matt? Oh.
In general, when you have backfires, it's because you have unburned petroleum in your exhaust.
There
and when it hits the hot exhaust, it goes bang. Which is what petroleum likes to do at high temperature.
Yeah, that's what it's designed to do. So in 2011, Lotus were trying to then use the exhaust, doing this thing where you're having constant exhaust fumes, but using it to create some kind of aero effect.
Yeah, so pretty much everyone was doing it, but Lotus's exhaust came out of the front, which was very, very bizarre. It didn't quite have the intended effect. But this Tyrrell, it was so utterly groundbreaking, and it was actually incredibly competitive. It came about in the fourth round of that season and was very, very quick straight out the blocks. And it even got pole and led a 1-2 at the Swedish Grand Prix in only its fourth race. But the problem with it was not very good on the brakes. It wore through them quite quickly. And if you know, we're on a bumpy circuit in particular, it would be incredibly difficult to break.
So the reason I mentioned the Lotus was you come up with something that different, like the Twin Tusks or like McLaren with their rear wings that was almost like a rib cage that was like brakes. It's either genius or there's a reason that no one else thought about it. So, yeah, in all those cases, there's a reason no one else thought about it.
Yeah, it's like when Nissan tried to do a front-wheel drive Le Mans car in 2015.
Yeah.
I think there's a reason why all racing cars are rear-wheel drive, pretty much. I think it's just a proven concept. But what killed off this car, unfortunately, aside from the sort of braking issues, you could sort of cope with it. But what really killed it off was the fact that Goodyear didn't develop the tires for it because they were bespoke and unique to that car. So everyone else's tires got developed all through the 76 season and through 77 as well. And Tyrrell's dedicated tires were not. And then eventually six-wheel cars were banned in the early 80s.
Okay. Well, they look stupid, but I had...
It does look a little bit odd, doesn't it?
Only a few people will understand this, but my first proper bike, after passing my proper bike test... That's right. I know I slate motorbike racing because it is witchcraft, but I was a biker when I was younger, was a Honda V-Twin 250. And the unique thing about this thing, apart from sounding like a tractor and only going about 80 miles an hour, was that the front wheel was only like 14 inches and the rear wheel was like a normal size. And it just was horrible for handling. So like a small front wheel, it was just so unforgiving. You had to use your body weight. There was no way you could like, at slow speed, turn the handlebars and you just fall down, as motorbikes should when they lean over MotoGP with your witchcraft. But if you look at these front wheels as well, I suppose they are rotating quicker than the other wheels. So surely they'll wear more because, you know, that bit of tire is getting back to the track that much sooner. And having two sets of front wheels, they're not sharing that burden. They're still going to wear quicker. So I'm interested to get Matt's take on whether you think that if we had a six-wheeled F1 car now, if Haas could turn up with a six-wheeled F1 car, would that... I don't understand what could help.
Well, the big help is you just add the two contact patches together. So instead of a 13-inch contact patch, you have two 10-inch contact patches, which is roughly the equivalent of one you'd get on a 20-inch wheel. So you had so much more bite at the front of the car. That it possessed an advantage, and you have lower rolling resistance with smaller wheels.
What about like friction and differential? So if you've got four wheels turning, how do you make sure that they're not kind of fouling each other? Because they all must be wanting to turn at different speeds, or is that just passive? I guess it would be passive, maybe.
I don't know if they ran a front differential that year, but I assume that it would not be a great thing. The rear wheels, I know they had,
because they're powered.
Run the diff because they're powered, but it's not any different problem to have to solve. You just have one extra axle.
Chunkly Bumps in the, that's a great name, by the way, in the live chat room, reminding me that actually various other teams tried their own version of a six-wheel car, including Ferrari and Williams, but that was with four rear wheels, four driven rear wheels, rather than two at the front, four at the front.
All right. Well, it's not caught on. They banned it. And I think this is what happens, really, in a completely open formula, is that someone comes up with an innovation and it's either so good that everyone copies it, or it's so good that it gets banned, isn't it?
Well, yeah. How is it different from, say, the invention of the front wing or the turbo?
Mm.
You know, it's either something that's going to revolutionize the automotive industry, which is what Formula One was in the 50s, 60s, 70s, and to an extent the 80s as well. And over the years, that kind of influence has been on a, I don't want to say smaller scale, but it's been less visible, you know, and a lot less in your face. That's basically what it was.
Just the chat room, John M, telling us, since the wheels aren't driven, no diff is needed. They'll rotate the speed they need to get around the corner.
Is one of those things that came out of my mouth. And as I was saying it, I came up with a solution. I was like, thank you very much, chat room. You're always saving us there. And Marky made a comment about the noise. The noise was the engine emitting exhaust while the throttle was off. The cold blown diffuser literally uses the cylinder as a pump. Not as effective, but the other way had been banned.
Well, that was in the same sort of era where they were cutting cylinders in low-speed corners to help with traction and fuel efficiency as well. And Renault were the kings of that, which is part of the reason why Red Bull was so successful in that era.
So that's like a V10, and they were like...
V8 back then. It was the V8 that would go down to four cylinders.
So you just go, right, just cut half the engine off in a slow-speed corner, and then get it fired back up again, just using the momentum of the car in gear, I suppose.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. My Honda VT250 used to just do that all by itself. There we go.
Not by design, though.
Well, I'm sure it was down to one cylinder at certain points. Okay. That's really fascinating. I think, you know, this is about the soul of Formula One. Brad Philpott said on a recent Twitter space of mine, he said, let's just make it a spec series. He said, the thing that interests everyone about F1 is the drivers. So why not just make it a spec series? To me, as a something-something-year F1 fan, I think I've always enjoyed the competition. But I think as aero has become more and more important, I think I've enjoyed the tech battles less and less because it's invisible. And I don't know what has happened to Formula One, that the aerodynamicist department seem to have this chokehold almost on Formula One, where you couldn't even try one season where you go, okay, let's take the front and rear wings off. Let's see who does the best. You could never do that because there's such an ingrained aerodynamic philosophy in F1.
I mean, I think that's a great idea if you want to just stifle innovation to make it a spec series. Frankly, I love the fact that there are a handful of motor racing series and they're all at the pinnacle of their particular discipline, where you design the whole car. Formula One, and even then, that's only a handful
within certain
teams.
Boxes as well.
The hypercar class in the World Endurance Championship, MotoGP, where the manufacturers make their own bikes, and probably WRC as well. But even then, you're starting off with a road car, so probably not even that.
But
I don't like the fact that that's a dying breed, really.
Well, it is. But the thing is, because the margins have been so squeezed in Formula One around aerodynamics, they have to they've basically specced a lot of everything else except aerodynamics and the flaws, which in a lot of ways is just how everything interacts with aerodynamics. Maybe F1 needs to be harsher with the tools it takes away. We don't need Formula One to get any faster. We don't need it to circulate tracks at a lower lap time. To an extent with these regulations, they took away some of their aero tools. But I find it politically interesting that I don't think F1 as a body could say, you're not allowed front wings anymore. Or here's a spec front wing, crack on, do everything else. I think the teams and the sport would never allow that.
Well, I'll tell you what as well. Let me take this opportunity to disprove the biggest misconception with, say, spec series in general, which is that they're cheaper, which is just not true. Because as soon as you make it a spec series, that one supplier gets to say, oh, this costs X amount now. Whereas before, so take Formula 2, for example, back in the Formula 3000 days in the 80s, 90s, and early 2000s, the teams would be sort of bargaining deals with certain manufacturers and suppliers for chassis and tires and engines and things like this. And it was a very well-run thing, and the cost was under control. As soon as it went to being a spec series, suddenly they're all paying more money for the same thing.
You're listening to Missed Apex Podcast. It's a Patreon-supported show. Go and check out the Patreon perks by going to patreon.com/MissedApex. The general idea is that it's a micropayment, which all in all, combined with a bunch of different people, makes it a big enough thing to mean that me and Matt and Chris now actually can do some work for Missed Apex Podcast, and it can be part of our freelance calendar. Without our patrons, this would not have survived. Other pressures would have come in and swamped us. Instead, we've been able to grow and thrive and become the world's highest ranked, host-owned, independent Formula One podcast. I'm pretty sure of that stat, but if you look at the iTunes ratings, I think it is pretty clear. Every F1 show above us has big funding behind them. So if you want to be part of keeping us up there with the big boys, check out patreon.com/MissedApex. All right, Matt, have you had a little delve into our listener mailbag?
I have indeed, although this particular question comes to us from the Twitters and is from our friend Luke Leduc. And he asks, what miles per gallon does this generation of Formula One cars achieve? Yeah. And so without getting into the cost of filling things up, because that appears to change on a daily basis, I have a brief and entertaining overview.
Brilliant. Yeah. And I think, you know, this kind of stuff is relevant because whether we like it or not, Formula One feels, or it appears to feel, a pressure to be road relevant, to talk about, you know, to lead technologies in the automotive industry. And while some of us could kind of go, well, what's that got to do with just 20 cars racing around, you know, in a circle, I can't see the pinnacle of motorsport ever really existing in a bubble like that without engaging with the broader automotive world.
Yeah, and this really gets to the heart of the 2014 regulations, where we added the MGUH and the MGUK. So looking back, once upon a time, Formula One was wild west of regulations, yeah. And they measured their fuel in the liters, which I think is probably what you do over there now. We use gallons over here, but it's the same thing. It's a volume measurement. And in 86, you were allowed a maximum fuel load of 195 liters, which was dropped to 155 liters in 88. And it stayed more or less there until I think the late 90s, when they switched to measuring by weight, because as it turns out, if you play games with the temperatures and the pressures, that you can get more fuel into the same volume if you try hard. And this is something Formula One teams remarkably discovered on their own. So it was set at 140 kilograms until the 2014 regulations, where it got changed to 100 kilograms.
Okay.
And think about the increase in efficiency, because the length of the Grand Prix did not change. And suddenly we're 40 kilograms less to achieve the same distance at the same speed.
Okay, there's not going to be a test on those figures, is there? Because like, what's the gist of this? Is that it's got better, presumably?
Massively better. I mean, you know, imagine if suddenly it's more than 40%. It's like 36% improvement in fuel efficiency. And since all internal combustion engines are indeed thermal engines, we're seeing over 50% efficiency versus in the low 30s for a standard internal combustion engine only. But to answer the actual question, in the least amount of time I've ever taken to get to it, if okay. we assume 100 kilogram fuel load and a 306 kilometer race, you're talking about 3.06 kilometers per kilogram, which works out to be about 7.5 miles per gallon if you assume a kilogram and a liter are the same, which they are at certain temperatures and pressures. Just going to say it. yes, you can tweet me exactly how wrong I am at temperature X and pressure Y. But at Matt PT 55.
I just need to be very clear. It's at Matt PT 55. No other handle. Okay.
Yeah. You just go right ahead and hit up at Spanners Ready on Twitter and tell them how wrong I was.
Chris.
If we're at 95 kilograms, that goes up to 3.22. And they've increased the fuel because the weight has gone up. We're up to 115, but teams rarely run that amount of fuel. So even if we assume they're close to that at 110 kilograms, that's 2.78 per liter or 6.95 miles per gallon. So your answer is roughly, between 7-8 miles per gallon, if my guess is to the average amount of fuel being used is correct. And I know Chris is going to say, oh, no, they use way less. They use way no. We don't. Yeah, but I had to make some assumptions.
Who asked the question?
That, again, would be our friend Luke Loduc on Twitter.
Not my friend, Luke. You and me, we've fallen out. Chris.
So it sounds like a horrendous number, doesn't it? 7.5 miles to the gallon. And it goes back to what we were talking about, the tires, right? They do 10 kilometers before they're past their best. How on earth is that road relevant? And you've got to remember, we are talking about the absolute pinnacle of what a car can do and the utterly extreme pressures that the power units, that the tires, that everything is under, which in your road car is 0.1% of what a Formula One car can do. That is why motor racing is the best test bed for new innovations and technologies. And so when we say that we can do 7.5 miles per gallon in a Formula One car, that might equivalent to 80 in a normal road car.
Equivalent, eh? Why is fuel efficiency important? Like you said, the tires last a handful of miles. An engine lasts what is a Formula One race? 200 miles times 8?
305-ish kilometers, whatever that is in miles.
Okay, I know I'm a fan of the metric system, but I just don't know kilometers.
No, I don't know either, but okay. I never learn what it is in miles because it's always been measured in kilometers. Okay.
So it's meant it lasts like 250 kilometers. And then your engine blows up and is no good. Why are we thriving for fuel efficiency in motorsport? Why is everything else allowed to wear out way quicker than it would in your road car, but we have to somehow be fuel efficient?
Wait, hang on. I'm not sure I agree with that because the engines have to last longer and longer and longer.
Yeah, eight
engines per season. Now we have three.
Eight races. 200. How long does your road car last? It lasts like 200,000 miles.
That's what we would. It's what we were just talking about, extreme pressures of it. And when you apply that to a road car, it is incredibly long-lived.
Matt?
Yeah, well, I just, in order to make the point I'd like to make about this, I just want to say, imagine you had to put 140 liters of fuel into your car to get where you're going. And then you get a new car, and now you only need 100 liters to get to the same place. That's the kind of improvement we're talking about. Yeah, in absolute terms, it doesn't seem great, but you have to understand that these engines are being run at RPMs your car engine won't even do for 90 minutes straight without stopping. And your car never, ever, ever does that.
And that's the point. If we rode our road cars, if we could somehow make them go and do an F1 lap time, they wouldn't be as efficient as the Formula One hybrid engines.
And they would not last either. They would go boom very quickly.
Fair enough.
And think about that money you'd be saving as well. What's that, 80 quid for 40 litres?
Don't, mate. It's too much. It's way too much.
Oh, I know. Okay.
So, Matt, very interesting. Is there any more points on this fuel efficiency question?
No, just appreciate this engine while we have it. Okay. That's what I would say.
Okay. I'm sure that the subject matter is interesting and important and relevant. I'm just going to say that might not be the least dry segment on the show we've ever had. That's all. There was a lot of numbers. I might not necessarily want to repeat that maths fest. And to anyone out there who's confused and angry, just remember it's all Matt's fault. So I'm going to go to some juicy driver gossip now. More than anything, it made me sleepy, not because I was bored. It was just that I was having to use too much brain power to keep up. Okay, so this question is from Jesse. And this is a really interesting question for older F1 fans who take a lot of stuff for granted. But we do have to remember there's a lot of newer fans here who are finding F1 and the personalities involved in their current state. So Jesse says, new F1 fan here. I'm getting to the stage of life where I always root for the wily old veteran, which means, of course, Fernando Alonso is one of my favourite drivers to watch. He's shaking his fist at the whippersnapper Tsunoda in the middle of an overtake. I don't think that was his fist, unless his fist is very, very narrow. Or calmly explaining over the radio, yeah, no problem. I want Norris close to me so that I can kill his tyres. This is quality material, posits Jesse. But I've picked up on more than a hint of exasperation and eye-rolling every time his name comes up on the podcast. What gives? What did he do at Ferrari and McLaren to sully his name? And obviously, to those of us who've been watching a while, I have a bit of sympathy for that, because there is very much an Uncle Fernando vibe. You know, that he's the crazy F1 uncle. He's still fast. He's throwing out his opinions. He can say whatever he wants, just like he's some lovable old rogue. But Fernando Alonso, who I am a fan of as well, by the way, Jesse, especially these days, so it's not lost on us. But he was the baddie, Chris. He properly was, wasn't he?
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Yeah, so I will also second that. I am a huge Fernando Alonso fan and is no doubt one of the most talented drivers ever to grace the sport. And I think it's criminal that he only has 2 world championships to his name, because I think it's something like 8 points more in his career would give him another 4 titles or something ridiculous.
I don't think it's criminal like he's been robbed, because I do feel like Fernando Alonso has made enough bad decisions and done enough wrong things that if he was a 5-time world champion, I would be sitting here going, do you know what? He deserves to only have 2, the git. And this is from someone who's professing to be a fan.
Well, I like the fact that they are a new enough fan that they left Renault entirely out of this conversation.
Oh, my goodness. Yes, that's true. Well, anyway, Chris, do you want to give us a potted history?
Well, what it comes down to is that he is known for being a disruptor within the team he works for. And looking at the 2007 McLaren case where he sparked issues with
Lewis
Hamilton.
Explain all of that right now. Remind me.
Okay, well, the most famous, the sort of flashpoint was the Hungary qualifying. So back in the days of refueling, you would refuel in the middle of the qualifying session in the pit lane. He was in front of Lewis Hamilton in the box getting refueled, ready to go out for his last run. And the lollipop goes back in the days of the lollipop man.
Oh,
remember that?
Lollipop
traffic
man.
Light system.
I do remember.
So lollipop man says, go, go, go. And he just sits there. He just sits there, runs the clock until Lewis doesn't have enough time to set a qualifying, a final running qualifying,
that
and bags himself.
Outrageous. Your teammate.
He has caused just too many issues with the teams that he's been driving for. And he did it at McLaren, he did it at Renault, he did it at Ferrari, he did it at McLaren again when they were with Honda from 2015. Mm. And I wouldn't be surprised if he's kind of doing it at Alpine now.
Well, it's hard to say what's going on at Alpine right now. There's a surface calm.
Yeah, it feels synergistic.
But I see the potential could be there. Am I wrong in thinking his first stint in McLaren, did he not also turn them in for having illegal Ferrari plans?
Okay. Oh, God, yay.
Yeah. Okay. I don't know if we have to say allegedly anymore or whatever, but the idea was that he'd come from Renault.
Yes.
To McLaren, and that he'd been sent illegal documents, which he had then could potentially have shared.
I think that they were sent to an engineer at McLaren, but he knew about it and informed the FIA when it was clear that McLaren weren't going to hobble Lewis in their fight. Or at least that's how the story goes that I know casually. I wasn't following.
Oh, so he was willing to put McLaren in the poop, rather than but then again, McLaren were the ones that were doing something bad. Alonso was just like, yeah. So hang on, are you saying that you're in the snitches get stitches mentality, and that's why we're blaming Alonso? Surely we could say Alonso is not a snitch, he's a whistleblower, a hero in many ways, Chris.
Well, it's worth remembering as well that the whole sort of Spygate scandal was what ended McLaren's works relationship with Mercedes as an engine supplier, and it was part of the reason anyway.
Yeah, okay.
It was one of many, many factors of things really imploding at McLaren. It's why they haven't won a world championship since 2008. But that's eventually what led to Mercedes having their own team in Formula One, and rather than just being with McLaren.
So Maria has said what I was trying to spit out as well, but they said, wasn't it the Ferrari's papers? And that was in my head as well. And then went, oh, hang on a minute. He came from Renault. So it was McLaren had somehow got hold of Ferrari blueprints or whatever. Right. But there was no proof they ever used them.
Yes, that's correct. Just like there was no proof there was ever traction control at Benetton and blah, blah, blah.
And Red
blah,
Bull
blah,
2013.
Blah. Yes, exactly.
No, lawyers, no. That was following Matt saying there was no proof of those things. And then I added another thing there was also no proof of.
Or that Mercedes benefited from their secret tire test in 2013.
No, I think they admitted as much, but they just argued that it was technically quasi-legal, sort of based on some emails that got sent once upon a time.
No, it was no benefit at all. They didn't magically start winning races after that. Sorry, I feel like I distracted you from your point.
I was going to make a different point. But no, when the current next generation of tires came out, suddenly their rear tires stopped melting.
Because they were fantastically quick in qualifying, weren't they? Yeah. They would lock out the front row and then be 16th after five laps.
Yeah, they'd be very quick for about three laps and their tires would melt and that would be the end of their race. And it's always interesting to look at Lotus performance in light of the fact that Lotus gave Pirelli their only test bed in Formula One for some years.
Mm-hmm.
And then magically, they always did really well with their tires. I mean, there's a certain amount of tire development. And if you've given them your car, well, you're going to kind of benefit from that. Anyway.
So Alonso, though, in 2005, 2006, he was, to me, the guy that was coming in and saving us from Michael Schumacher. So at least on that level, it was a breath of fresh air. Formula One's got this bright young new champion.
Yeah, and he had that amazing pass around the outside of 130. Was it the outside of 130 R at Suzuka? And he just absolutely took it to Schumacher. And it was amazing.
Yeah.
Right up until the time they started crashing cars for him to win races.
And people who are new to Formula One as well, Michael Schumacher at that time, that early 2000s period, if you think Mercedes and Hamilton were dominant, like Schumacher, it was a different level. They were an absolute machine, and Schumacher was never challenged at all by a teammate. And in fact, probably would have been eight for not that leg break. I can't remember what year that was. Was it
1999?
Was it 99? Was it so he broke his leg. Irvine came in and should have won the title, but
Irvine is no Schumacher.
Yeah, but there's also controversy around that Ferrari didn't want someone other than their champion to win to win that championship. But anyway, yeah, so Schumacher was all powerful, all dominant, and there was no doubt at the time either that he was a dominant force in Formula One driver sphere. So, you know, people will say of Lewis Hamilton's championships, oh, he always had the best car. Other drivers could have done the same. And no, and I think, you know, I think it's fair to say Lewis Hamilton, A, has aided in development of cars, B, was also a phenomenon. But it's also fair to say that Lewis Hamilton had better drivers around him than Michael Schumacher did. Michael Schumacher truly emerged as a brand new force, a brand new type of driver. So that's when we say you have to imagine the domination of the Schumacher era, he was a truly different type of driver.
For me, Schumacher's arrival in 92 marked the era where the professional racing driver was kind of born. I think even up until the 80s, it was becoming more pro and there was better preparation for the drivers coming up through the junior formula. But 92, when Schumacher came in, marked, you know, the start of something new about what a successful Formula One driver had to be. And I think Lewis Hamilton in some ways raised that bar.
And this is it. And then the generation of drivers that came through had to be at least Michael Schumacher level. Yeah. So Alonso, Lewis Hamilton, Raikkonen, all those guys came through in the shadow of probably those guys watched Michael Schumacher and saw that's the level of physical athlete you have to be now to be a Formula One driver.
Just to touch upon what you said about never being challenged, there were some close battles that he had. Obviously, 2000 was another.
No, with teammates. I specifically meant teammates.
But yeah, no, it was always from, it was either from Mika Häkkinen at McLaren or Kimi Räikkönen at McLaren or people in the Montoya, it was in the Williams in 03 as well. But just to go back to Alonso real quick. And actually, Maria's
yes, you're right here to bring it back to Alonso. But what I was trying to paint the picture of was how much of a relief Alonso was to come in and go, oh, it's over, thank goodness.
And massively like popular as well, because Formula One in Spain was not a really big thing. There was no like big Spanish racing drivers before Fernando Alonso came around. And obviously now we have got Carlos Sainz Jr., kind of carrying on that mantle, as it were. But I think the other thing that sours Fernando Alonso a little bit is the 2008 Crashgate. And he will deny to this day that he knew anything about
quickly,
it. But I don't think you're going to convince
people of that. What happened?
So in that race, Renault told Nelson Piquet Jr. to deliberately crash his car in Singapore to bring out a safety car, which brought Fernando Alonso to the lead of the race, and when he qualified like 16th or something like ridiculous, and that crash helped him win the race, and also lie about it afterwards. It wasn't until 12 months later, because Piquet's reward for that was getting another contract with them for the following year, when they suddenly terminated his contract halfway through the season. Ooh. He went and blew the whistle.
Ooh.
And let's be really clear, they pitted Alonso at a very strange time.
Yeah.
And he had just come out on fresh tires, and like the very next lap was the Piquet crash. So everybody else came into the pits, which left him basically leading the race. And that was the same race where Massa drove off with the fuel line still attached and ruined his chance, I believe, at the championship.
Yeah, and it's worth reminding people as well, that was in an era where they would close the pit lane exit as well, and you would sort of queue up when the safety car was coming around. So kind of stopping under safety car didn't mean the same thing it does now.
Oh, so okay, so that was my question, because if that had happened now and he'd pitted early, then there'd been a safety car. That would be a disaster because everybody else would get a very cheap pit stop. So back then, and this is something that I had completely lost through the annals of time, the pit lane would close for a safety car, so you couldn't pit. So
no, you could, but you would have to queue at the... It was the exit that was closed.
Oh, my goodness.
So you could pit and wait for the queue to come round.
And then so you would get automatically put at the back. So you could have fresh tyres, but you'd be behind everyone else that hadn't pitted.
Yeah, there was another reason Felipe Massa lost the world championship that year, and that's because he left the pit lane on a red light in Canada. There were loads of people who got disqualified for that day. I can't remember why, but it was caught out a lot of people that day.
Yeah, and Andy got robbed by Glock deliberately just moving out of the way for him.
Yeah, for, slowing for down for Lewis.
Yeah. No, that's obviously a rubbish conspiracy theory. It was a crazy season because Lewis Hamilton also got like a... Didn't he get disqualified or got a massive penalty for not yielding...
Spa.
For Spa. Yeah, basically Raikkonen... He was accused of overtaking Raikkonen illegally, so he gave the place back, but then immediately retook the place. And yeah. then, I can't remember what the punishment was, but he lost.
He got dropped to third with a time penalty rather than winning the race, which seems ridiculous because Raikkonen crashed out like the following lap as well.
But in all this nostalgia, again, Fernando Alonso isn't really complicit in that. There's no evidence, is there, that Fernando Alonso was involved in that plan to have a junior driver, deliberately crash into the pit lane to cause a safety car?
Yeah, no evidence.
Well, I mean, I think if I'm going to play the part of the prosecutor here, I don't think it's whether he was involved in the plot per se. Was it his idea? Did he originate it? I think the bigger question is, was he aware of it? And we certainly have evidence with Spygate later on that he has no problems going to the FIA if he thinks it will benefit him.
Yeah.
And yet he's told to pit, you know, six laps before he normally would. And without argument, I mean, I look at people like Carlos Sainz, like, what are you telling me on this radio, engineer? No argument that I'm aware of, does exactly what they say and winds up leading the race and then says nothing about it until he's asked by the FIA once Piquet Jr. came forward.
So I'd argue that this is all kind of circumstantial a little bit. If we're trying to sully Alonso's character and say, why do people dislike him? He didn't have a dominating period like Schumacher, like Lewis Hamilton. It was a blip in F1 history. It was two championships with Renault. We don't know he had anything to do with Crashgate. He wasn't the perpetrator of Spygate. We could say that he was a whistleblower. So why the hate, Chris?
Yeah, I mean, look, I'm not trying to sully anyone's reputation. This is just a number of reasons why some teams are quite reluctant to take on Fernando Alonso. Actually, I think if rumors were true, Mercedes is one of them.
And the point I would make is that these all come from young Fernando. He might have known. He said nothing. That's kind of a blot on your character, but there are certain other drivers in certain situations who have not necessarily said things when maybe they could have.
We have to remember Lewis Hamilton was instructed allegedly. Yep. I think he got a penalty for this, so I don't think this is allegedly. His team told him to lie about the reasons why he did an unsafe rejoin, and he went along with it, and I think has since gone, oh, I shouldn't have done that. But you can understand the pressure the drivers are under.
And so I want to make the point that as much as we're looking at, for the benefit of this question, Alonso's quote-unquote past sins, that doesn't mean that he would do that today or that he's entirely like that today.
So you're saying there's a redemption arc. Please, please let there be redemption arcs in life. Let those be real.
So do we think that Lewis Hamilton knew anything about the fact that really McLaren weren't allowed to win the 2007 World Championship because of Spygate?
That's alleged. That's a huge alleged.
Come on. Come on. There is no way they were ever going to let McLaren win that World Championship.
Massive allegedly there. But so I think just to summarise, I don't think this will lead to much further discussion, but Fernando Alonso, as you said, a disruptor. Lots of reports out of that 2007 McLaren series, that season with Hamilton, that it became very much a divided grid. Do you necessarily want that? One comment that comes to mind, and it will live with me because this is such a classic Alonso quote. It was at Spa, a track that is renowned for... Oh, no, it wasn't. It was Monza. It was Monza, a track that is renowned for, you know, there's not a lot of places where you can really kind of make a difference compared to your teammate. Say a lot of other tracks, you might have a big gap, but there are tracks like Barcelona, like Spa, like Monza, where maybe teammates are more likely to be together. And on the grid, he looked at qualifying and he just threw Raikkonen under the bus in an interview. He said, look at the other cars, you know, teammates. I'm here. Look at Raikkonen. He's all the way down the back. And even though he clearly would have been getting preferential treatment from Ferrari at that time, he was still happy to throw Raikkonen under the bus by saying, look how good I am. I am the only person who is able to qualify much higher than his teammate. I don't know if they then went and had an espresso together after the race, but if I was Raikkonen, I certainly wouldn't. And, you know, Raikkonen was used as a... I mean, sometimes I feel like, you know, they forgot about Raikkonen in those races, but he was often used to just, like, you know, stay out on old tyres, never pit, and just see who you can hold up behind Alonso. We know he was disruptive in his partnership with Honda, as Chris said as well. So I think it's that disruptive nature that has, quote-unquote, sullied his name, according to Jesse. So anyway, Jesse, I know it was a relatively innocuous question, but I think it's lovely, actually, to have this this view back and go...
Innocuous.
Litigious,
maybe.
From his point of view, innocuous. Litigious from our point of view. But I think you're right, Matt. We have to reassess what we think, because we've got a lot of baggage as F1 fans from the before times. As we find him now, I still find myself an Alonso fan. And you go, well, okay, is there a redemption arc? Because, you know, he's a crusty old man like me. He's seen things. He remembers the before time. You know, I don't know. I hope there's a redemption arc for people. Otherwise, I should hang up my mic. Okay, not as much time for these two subjects as I wanted to have, but we'll finish on the Sainz question from Matt. First, Chris, a little bit of breaking news. The Red Bull Porsche something something.
Yes, so the long rumored collaboration between Red Bull and Porsche is set to be announced next week. There's been some documents that have been unveiled, basically because everything is going through the European Union. About 20 different countries have to sign off on this collaboration, and all the boxes have been ticked now, and that means we've got some documents we can actually, you know, publicly look at. And what it seems to be is a 10-year partnership between Red Bull and Porsche, where Porsche will buy a 50% stake in both the Grand Prix team and Red Bull Technologies, which is what's responsible for the power units in Formula One. And that is incredibly exciting to finally have this done. And what's been delayed, because I know it was rumored to be announced at the Austrian Grand Prix, Red Bull's home race, was that the 2026 regulations, the engine regulations, it was a stipulation on Porsche's side that those regulations had to be nailed down before this was announced. And do you know what? For me, this means from 2026, I have to be a Red Bull fan, because I love Porsche. Anyone who's seen me tweet about GT or endurance racing knows that I am a Porsche fanatic. Had nothing to do with who I've previously worked with, I swear. I've got another team to root for. Wonderful.
Yeah. And how is that going to look when Honda up and wanders off with all of its IP? I mean, you know, and are we even sure Porsche will really, really, really show up? Because how many times have we been promised Audi or VW or Porsche will be a Formula One team, only for that not to really happen?
Well, didn't Red Bull buy the Honda IP, though? So therefore, it will sort of get transferred to Porsche.
I don't know the answer to that question.
I'm pretty sure they did, because that's why Red Bull powered... What's it called? Red Bull powered trains. Yeah, RBPT is what sort of develops the powertrain. Now, I put develops in sort of quote marks because they put an engine freeze in.
Yeah, well, I mean, but are they not still building the engine in Japan? And are we not hearing rumors that Honda might stick around as a power unit supplier?
Well, yeah, I'm sure that's legally a bit messy. I would have to go back and double check who currently owns the IP for the power unit that Red Bull has in the back of its car at the moment.
What interests me is, are they going to be building this engine, or are they going to be designing this engine? In other words, are they simply the Tag Heuer in this?
No. I think Tag Heuer was just a way to avoid it being called a Renault, and was a bit of money. This is, you know, full on buying half of the Red Bull's Grand Prix operations, whether it's designing or building or both. Or, you know, how much the collaboration is going to be. I'm sure those details will come at a later date.
Yeah, and how sure are we that this is really going to happen?
Well, they say it's going to be announced next week. So
who says it's going to be announced next week?
Oh, sorry, I should have absolutely started this at the beginning. This is all on motorsport.com.
And who's their source and who wrote it?
Well, their source is based on the documents that I was talking about that came out of Morocco, I believe it was, because of this whole European Union, 20 countries having to sign off on it.
No, only 52% of the countries have to sign off it, and then you can do whatever you want, no matter what the consequences are.
I don't really understand the process, to be honest.
Okay, it was a slight reference you might not have picked up. I'm very, very subtle. So is this technically still rumour?
I mean, technically, yes, until it gets formally announced, but I'm pretty confident that this is happening.
Okay, and how will it affect the operations of the team would be the next question, because 50%, what is that? That's a really odd number, 50%. All right, cool. Who makes the call? Do we still have to listen to interviews from bonkers elements of the Red Bull management saying wildly, inappropriately, culturally insensitive things about why their drivers might have performed poorly on a given Grand Prix?
Well,
although so, I will say, if it was tequila, that would explain
Helmut Marko's not going anywhere.
Okay,
but I think you'll start to see Porsche's involvement in Formula One from 2026, where they'll have, you know, Porsche engineers in the garage, probably as, you know, representatives. They'll talk to the media from the power unit point of view. And maybe even in the same way that Honda had junior drivers coming up through the single seater ranks that were basically Red Bull drivers, we might start seeing Porsche juniors.
Oh, you flip flopped between Porsche and Porsche. Pick a lane. You said Porsche all the way through the start of it, and now you've flipped to Porsche. I'm not having it.
I mean, well, look, Honda had junior drivers. Maybe it will be Porsche now.
No, Matt knows what I mean.
I know exactly what you mean, because ich spreche ein bisschen Deutsch vielleicht.
Entschuldigung bitte, wo ist das neben Krankenhausen? Ich habe Durchfall. I also speak some German.
Mein Deutsch ist nicht sehr gut.
The last question I have, and I think the most interesting thing is it's one thing to say you're buying 50% of something, but it's another thing to have operational control. I can very easily see a structure where Porsche invest, take part of the profits, but that the people who still run Red Bull. They just pay less for it now.
And if they didn't, let's say Red Bull were capitulating, saying, well, this is effectively our exit strategy from Formula One and we're handing over to Porsche, Chris, then
no.
You can't change back. Yeah, you just went Team Porsche.
I can have either.
Right, roll the tape, Steve. Okay, so that would represent another works team in Formula One. And to me, that's another nail in the hope that we might not have franchise F1 coffin. I'm not excited about Porsche entering Formula One. Now, I know that a lot of people who are into sports cars and have followed Porsche's other racing exploits, they might be excited about that. But as an F1 fan, to me, it is just another automotive manufacturer entering F1 as a sport. Tell me why I'm wrong, Chris. I don't want it just to be Volkswagen, Porsche, Mercedes, Ferrari.
Well, it won't be. There will still be customer teams on the grid, and this is
which
having,
ones? Wait, we've got Alfa Romeo. What? So we've got who we got
Alfa,
left?
Oh, Alfa Romeo is not a manufacturer. It's Sauber with a badge on it. And it's the same. It was the same with Caterham, with Lotus, with all the other ones as well. There are so many teams that have got Aston Martin is barely linked to the road car program.
How dare you? That is a legitimate enterprise that just happens to have picked Lance Stroll as its lead driver.
Look, there will still be customer teams. You'll still see Formula One as we know and love it. This is just one more match. And actually, really, it's only going to be with two teams, isn't it? Because it's only going to be Red Bull and AlphaTauri. I doubt we'll see anyone else getting Porsche engines out of this. And, you know, if Honda don't stick around, which is still a possibility, then we haven't really lost anything overall in terms of the number of manufacturers. So I don't think it's going to change all that much.
I think we've got time for another Matt story time, haven't we? Because Matt has picked out a question from our listener mailbag, feedback@missedapex.net. Now, Matt, this is another, I feel like it's going to be another information and number heavy question.
I feel bad. Like you should be playing like the Brahms lullaby here.
Do you know what? Because I knew you were assessing this and I knew there was a lot of information, I poured myself an extra stiff drink. I've got the bumper ready. And I'm just going to say, everyone, gather round the tree. and it's time for Uncle Trumpets to tell us a story. Off you go, sir.
Yes. Well, our friend Matt Miller writes in and wants to know about Ferrari's strategy with signs. And happily, I was already looking into that thanks to a Twitter exchange yesterday. And specifically, he wants to know, what if Ferrari didn't pit him under the safety car? What if they ran him up the front on the hards and ran out that stint? Yes, they would have paid a full pit stop penalty, but there wouldn't be a 5-second penalty, one assumes, associated with it. And had it gone well, could he have done better than he did?
Any safety car now, fans of any team or driver will be screaming for their team or driver to pit, to take this free pit stop that's been lauded. Why don't we see teams just go, okay, just especially early in the race, just get your track position, hold up some teams, and stick to your initial strategy, because you save 10 seconds, but you give up your whole strategy.
Yeah, well, and the problem with signs in this strategy is the timing of it. That safety car was just too early, potentially, to get to the end. And I know people will say Gasly got to the end. Well, Gasly was running like 139s.
Yeah,
Carlos is running 136s, 135s, and 137s. And that has a different effect on one's tires. I'm just going to say that. So I have not only looked at and understood what happened with the miscommunication amongst Ferrari, and I can talk about that, but I've looked at the three possible scenarios. Scenario one, everybody's favorite scenario, which is bitter end. You run those mediums to the end, and we're all sat there on our couches with the beers going, get her done, Carlos! And to the end he goes in third place, which I think was achievable. But the problem you have there is the 5-second penalty. Hamilton was 9 seconds behind the leader. Russell was 16 seconds behind the leader. He would have had to have basically caught Hamilton and lost zero time on those tires at the end of the race and under the virtual safety car. His margin of error there would have been less than a second. At which point, I'll remind you, what they did do was they did pit him, catch him up, get him past Alonso, and got him fast lap point, which got him the same points as Perez in P4. So he got a net fourth position. And being the only Ferrari on track, can you really blame them for not wanting to risk his tire blowing up or him spinning off the track and them getting another 11 points lost to Mercedes after Leclerc is already gone? Chris?
I also don't think this just get track position thing works in the new regulations, because we've seen it's easier to race, it's easier to follow, and the tire wear in particular seems to have gone up, maybe as a consequence, but the fact remains it seems to be higher than it was before. So I don't think you can just get the track position and then defend to the hills and just block everyone that tries to come through, you know, like a Monaco or something like this. I think it's too easy for it to go the other way now.
It is. But what's interesting about Sainz is we know he hadn't been super pushing on his hard tire, and we know that everybody else went onto the hard tire. So I'm going to say that at 18 lap old hard tires, to get to lap 28, when they started racing again on lap 22, I don't see that. Because 28, Ferrari told us it was a 25 lap limit on their medium tires. That's what Inaki said after the race. We felt they had a maximum life of 25 laps. Part of that was probably because they didn't have good data from Leclerc, because he crashed out too soon. But if we take them at their word, 25 laps, then he just had to get from lap 22 to lap 28, and he would have started directly behind Russell. So I can go to this scenario now, even though I gamed out the other scenario, and I can tell you that if he had pitted on lap 28, he would not have had a 5-second penalty, because Ferrari would not have unsafely released him in front of Albon, I believe. He would have lost 28 seconds, and he would have had the entirety of the rest of the race to make it back up. And his actual run on the medium tires, once they pitted him the second time, he was making about a second and a half a lap. He caught Alonso in five laps and went from 40 seconds back to 32 seconds back from lap 43 to lap 53. So
numbers,
you wouldn't be making that much back up over the whole race. But here's where I think it might have been genius, because at lap 28, he was only 6.6 seconds behind. And I'm assuming he keeps pace with Russell, who he would have been behind, doesn't try to pass him. He was 6.6 seconds back. If we go and look at lap 42, Russell is 17 seconds back, meaning he would have gained almost 10 seconds off of his 28-second pit stop. He would have only really had to make up 18 seconds.
Everyone keeping up with it?
Right. So the pit stop loss, 28 seconds. Okay. Russell goes from 6 seconds to 17 seconds, 6 to 16 seconds back. So Russell loses 10 seconds, which means that his net loss, if he's faster than Russell, is only 18 seconds.
Okay.
And he's got from lap 28 to the end of the race to make it up. Now, the downside to this is he would have literally come out at the very, he would have come out behind Schumacher and had to pass everybody, including Perez, who it took him 6 laps to get round.
Yeah.
And Russell. All right, let me try one more time. I'm using as a proxy how far away Russell is from Verstappen. On lap 28, he's 6 seconds back. And I'm assuming Carlos, had he not pitted, would have stayed with Russell. Not passed anyone, not done anything fancy, but he would have been at that same place. At the end of the race, Russell is 16 seconds behind Verstappen, meaning Russell loses 10 seconds. Carlos, coming on new tires, wouldn't lose those 10 seconds. So Russell drives 10 seconds backwards. It's a 28-second pit delta. But with that 10-second loss by Russell, now we're only looking at an 18 seconds. He only has to make up 18 seconds from lap 28 to lap 53. But he does have to pass both Perez and Russell to take third place.
Wow, you've really brought this to life for me, Matt. I think this is like, strategy is hard. And Mike Caulfield, the ex former Haas and Mercedes strategist, did a great segment for us on the magazine show a couple of weeks back. And actually, when that segment was finished, we stayed on the call with him for another 40 minutes. He showed us some little bits and bobs to show like the depth and breadth of the information that they have to look at. And just imagining trying to make those decisions in real time.
Yeah.
It is easy for us to say as armchair fans, but also, you know, a top strategist should be at the same level as a top driver. Like it should be that competitive, and I'm sure it is.
Okay. So I will tell you the story now of I don't think Ferrari got it that wrong. And I'll explain what I'm thinking. Up until lap 36.
Yeah. Yeah.
Carlos was catching. He was making time on everybody. Lap 36, he gets inside DRS on Perez. And if you're going to ding Ferrari, this is the lap where you say he should have been brought in, because he was stuck behind Perez and he started losing time. In fact, he lost, I'm going to look at my numbers right now. He went from about 10 seconds back to 14 seconds back by time he passed him. So he loses almost 4 seconds behind Perez from lap 36 to lap 42.
And that would have been enough to help him.
And that, those 4 seconds are almost the entirety of his penalty right there.
Okay, but I do still think Ferrari got it a lot wrong. Right.
Well, I mean, I'm saying if you brought him in lap 36.
Okay.
But there's a reason they didn't. Is because Carlos, once he passed Russell, they wanted to try and get him to the end on those tires. But he got stuck behind Perez, and Sainz was asking to be brought in, because he was stuck behind Perez and knew he was losing time. So Ferrari sat down and they looked at the numbers, as strategists do, and they realized, as long as we give him enough laps to catch Alonso, we can get him the same points as Perez. Seems like a win. Let's do it. And they had figured this out right before he passed Perez. And so they called him in, because the audio was off a little bit on the TV.
Okay.
He was past, Sainz was like, I want to stay out. Let's do another lap. But Ferrari were like, no, we have a much safer and easier way for you to get the same amount of points we think you're going to get, because we don't think you'll stay 5 seconds ahead. Why don't you come in and get new tires?
Matt, I want to thank you for all of that information. Sincerely, from the bottom of my heart, thank you for that information. And I know that there's a cult Matt Trumpets following out there. So, and I'm sure they appreciate it. No, a lot of research into that, a lot of good information, I'm sure. I followed all of it. So I now agree Ferrari did nothing wrong.
I would agree with you. It's almost impossible to put across in words.
Yeah.
It looks much neater on a piece of paper, I promise. But I looked at the numbers from the F1 app, and those are my conclusions.
Chris, you still with us?
Just about.
All right. Good. Chris, you got a really, 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 really fun, exciting weekend ahead. How are you preparing?
With 43 pages of notes, and watched all of the previous Formula E round in its entirety, like every practice session, all through qualifying. Make sure I know how they play out, because it's been a while since I've done that, actually. Because I used to be a Formula E journalist, very invested in it. Then did PR for a team for a little bit, and since then, I've not really been involved in it. So, it's good to be back.
Commentary, man, I've done a little bit. I'm not great. when you get parachuted into a series, impossible. When you have the time and the knowledge to do research and to do your homework and watch tapes back, it's a joy. But if you don't do the work, you won't be able to express yourself. And we know that you always do the work. In fact, that is your only real talent. That's not an insult. Work is your talent.
This is all your fault, because that one time at Buckmore when we were karting, you just handed me a microphone and went, talk.
Yeah, but the second time I handed you a dossier with all information from the driver.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, then we were prepared for it after that. Once we realised, he's actually quite good at this.
So if you are trackside, obviously enjoy Chris Stevens' commentary, and I'm sure you'll do the odd clip and the odd photo. Go and follow Chris on Twitter at ChrisOnRacing. EJ says, my conclusion from what Matt is saying is that we should conquer Sweden again. EJ is a Dane. So you can basically draw your own conclusions from what Matt is saying, which is great. Matt is at MattPT55 on Twitter, and on Instagram is where you find out all your gigs and stuff that you do, which is cool. You seem like you've played in some very lovely locations recently.
I have. I was very fortunate to go back to Lake George and play in the chapel that was designed by the same architect as Carnegie Hall, no less, from the 1850s.
And I'm pleased to say as well, if you look at our social media, increasingly at MissedApexF1 on Twitter, is being more and more slightly, managed, nudged and curated by Chris, who is a professional PR guy. So you might have noticed an uptick in the MissedApex quality and a downtick in the amount of typos and me just going, oi, sod off turnip.
So yeah, happy to. Well, I'm really happy to do it. It's nice. It's fun, creative, and yeah, hopefully you guys are enjoying the content.
And you can follow me as well at SpannersReady. We've got TikTok content increasing and growing. But also, if you want to see just some of like me knocking around in a not F1 way, I am trying to post more on Instagram, so you can follow me, SpannersReady, there. We will be back on Sunday at 8 p.m. for our Hungarian Grand Prix race review. But wherever we see you next, work hard, be kind, and have fun. This was Missed Apex Podcast.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
The secret to summer-ready skin is here. Osea's number one best-selling Andaria Algae Body Oil, clinically proven to instantly improve skin elasticity and transform dry skin to silky, soft, and unbelievably glowing. Its signature scent of freshly squeezed grapefruit, cypress, and mango mandarin transports you to sun-kissed summer days. Get healthy, glowing skin for summer with clean, vegan skincare from Osea. Get 10% off your first order site-wide with code GLOW at OseaMalibu.com.